Hello and welcome back to another episode of the weekly news segment within the For the Property Investor podcast. And I'd like to welcome back again, Nick Bendall. Thanks for being here and showing up every week with the latest news of the week for property investors. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing very well. It's always wonderful to see you and to chat about property and finance news.
Yes. And of course, very professionally you've got on your shirt today, Hunter and Scribe is your business. I've only just noticed that.
Well, it was funny when you said very professional, you've got a shirt on today. I was wondering, are you implying that I normally do this topless? But then you added a bit more information.
Yes, yes. It's that pregnant pause can be very dangerous. Yes. Mm. What's been happening for you in the past week at Hunter and Scribe?
Well, for those who don't know, Hunter and Scribe is a copywriting agency that writes content for property and finance professionals. And we've done a lot of that over the past week. And just to give you an example, we wrote a series of social media posts for a residential builder.
Great. Okay. So builders are a good potential client for you as well, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of our clients are mortgage brokers and buyer's agents and accountants and financial advisors. But we do work with builders as well because it is the same industry with the same sort of issues.
Cool. All right. Well, in the past week with us at Leafield, the big news is we've got our South Australian license through, so we will be adding that to our Western Australian operation that we started a bit over 12 months ago, and of course Queensland, Victoria, and New South Wales where we started. That rounds out all of the important markets that we want to be in. But I'm sure we'll get to the others at some point. For now, yes, looking forward to getting started in Adelaide in the coming month or so. That's the big news for us. But Nick, what have you brought us that's in the news this week?
Well, let's start with something that's very interesting, Owen, in terms of land tax. So Victoria expands vacant residential land tax. Victoria's tax on vacant residential land has been expanded from parts of inner Melbourne to all of Victoria. A property is declared vacant if it was not occupied for at least 6 months in the previous year. Properties will be taxed 1% if this vacancy period has covered 1 year, 2% for 2 years, and 3% for three or more years. The tax will be based on the capital improved value rather than the land value. Vacancy will be judged starting from January 1 this year, which means the first tax charges will be levied from January 1 next year. The tax, Owen, is designed to incentivize landlords to bring their property to market so as to increase the rental supply. Do you think this tax will work?
Interesting. It's to be honest, I hadn't come across this specific one in Victoria before. And looking at it, there could be worse taxes. Whether it will make a difference or not, I'm not sure. It's if people are keeping a property vacant for some reason, then there can be usually a specific reason, why someone wouldn't want to rent property out to get income from it. Who knows? So, there was a lot of reports that overseas investors were purely just parking cash in Australia in our safe residential property market and didn't want the bother of having to deal with having tenants when the income from it was so low, especially in Sydney. So and Melbourne wouldn't be too 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 different from that from a percentage return basis. So it's, will it work? If the property can be rented, like if it's habitable, and that's the details that we don't know in this short report of whether it's habitable or not, will that still attract the tax? Then yes, I hope so, because we need more properties on in the rental pool. Will it affect people who have a holiday home that they go and live in for, yeah, 1 or 2 months of the year themselves and not rent it out on Airbnb? You know, will that be affected? So yeah, there might be a few ifs, buts and maybes, so that we'd need to explore. But if people are purely just buying a property for that sake, then to park cash in it, then I think yes, it's a good idea. But yes, there's a few other boxes that need to be ticked, I think, first to understand.
Yeah. So would it be fair then? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Would it be fair then to say that you think this is a fair tax?
Again, if we were able to tick off some of those other boxes, like if people had their own personal holiday home, you know, is that included where they do use it every year? Will that be included? Is it habitable? They might be waiting for a DA to come through so that they can get it fixed. In those couple of cases, I think it would be unfair if that would attract the tax. But in cases where people are purposely not renting it out because they're just parking cash and they don't have they don't want the hassles of having to rent it, then yes, I think it's a fair tax.
You spoke earlier, Owen, about your hope that this would lead to more properties, more rental properties coming onto the market. Is there anything else Victoria could do to increase rental supply and put downward pressure on rents?
Come back to the old thing we keep coming back to, Nick, is more supply. And do things to attract renters, attract investors to buy more properties in Victoria. We haven't covered across their changes that Victoria has apparently made with their general land tax for investors. And so they're talking to a lot of buyer's agents, as I do, on a daily basis. Victoria is like the last state on the list for buying in at the moment. The rental returns aren't great. The laws they're bringing in to be able to give tenants effective control over the property that they're living in is making it very, very disincentivizes investors to come there. And then when they're being taxed more as a result for just being an investor in that state, why should they bother? It's we're already seeing it from property managers in Victoria, where they're saying that rents are starting to go up. There's a lot more investors choosing to sell rather than re-rent the property when it becomes vacant. So it's just adding up to a big mess in Victoria, and it's on top of their budget woes. It's just going to cause more and more problems in Victoria. So,
well, thanks for sharing your thoughts, Owen, on that issue. Let's move on to our next story. Home loan arrears below their pre-pandemic peak. The vast majority of mortgage holders are doing a good job managing their repayments based on the latest financial stability review from the Reserve Bank of Australia. About 0.6% of property investors have loans that are more than 90 days in arrears, while about 0.7% of owner-occupiers are in arrears. Despite pressures on households' budgets, almost all borrowers have been able to continue to service their debts. That's a quote from the RBA, and the quote continues. While housing and personal loan arrears have increased since late 2022, they remain below their pre-pandemic peak. At the same time, a small but increasing share of borrowers have requested and received temporary hardship arrangements from their lenders, which has contributed to arrears rates remaining a little lower than would have otherwise been the case. Owen, do you have any theories as to why mortgage arrears are so low?
Yeah, our economy is in good shape. Everyone keeps talking and trying to talk up a recession that's going to happen. And if there's still a risk of that, but unless we see unemployment start to take off, and I believe unemployment figures came out recently to be unexpectedly lower. And it just shows that, and we're having good wages growth. And there's a lot more positivity in the market as well. So it seems like the RBA has done its job with the rate rises we've received, and we're starting to level off now. So there's still a bit of turbulence as we're trying to level off and get some steadiness. But this is all good news, and it's not doom and gloom. And all we need now is more property supply to solve the issue of the housing crisis.
You made a very good point about unemployment being low. It recently fell from 4.1, which is low, to 3.7%, which is very low. The number one thing that determines whether someone can repay their mortgage is having a job. So very low unemployment helps. And as you also said, Owen, wages have been going up, which also makes it easier to repay a mortgage. So I guess that explains why arrears are about 0.6% for investors and about 0.7% for owner-occupiers. Are you surprised, by the way, that arrears are lower for investors than owner-occupiers?
It's not a huge difference. And given another 6 months, it could sway back the other way quite easily. Owner-occupiers, because the interest rates were so low during 2 or 3 years ago, a lot of first home buyers got into the market. With probably minimal deposits, and their repayments probably doubled in that time. Mm. And so they probably weren't quite prepared for all of that. So not surprised that more owner occupiers could be in trouble than investors. And because the trend for investors have been to go for more cash flow positive properties late rather than trying to buy just for capital growth. So regardless of what the income is. So investors have been a bit smarter in the last few years in what they're buying. That's our experience anyway, as property managers. And the owner-occupiers, due to the very low interest rates that we had, that's where the issue could be.
Sometimes people make the argument that an owner-occupier is more likely to repay their mortgage than an investor, because if you're an owner-occupier, if it's your home, you will do what whatever it takes, even if it means living on baked beans. However, I think that kind of ignores the view that it's much easier for an investor to repay their mortgage, given that their tenant is contributing a significant amount. And as this latest data shows, property investors have a better record in terms of arrears than owner-occupiers. What's interesting about that, Owen, is the reason banks charge higher interest rates for investors is because investors are meant to be higher risk borrowers than owner-occupiers, but this RBA data would suggest otherwise. So I'm wondering, should banks stop charging investors higher rates?
Well, then they never used to. That's only been since the Royal Commission that we had in, what was it, 2017-18, the bank started charging extra for investors. And so they haven't been doing that for that long. And that was their excuse. Historical data doesn't necessarily back that up. But then you've got a lot more rent investors as well these days, where they're paying rents that are much lower than for the properties that they're living in than what the mortgage would be. And they're buying more investment properties for the cash flow and to be in the market. So in terms of it's not too surprising. And banks, yes, there's no reason for them to be charging extra for property investors. Yeah, absolutely no reason. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to send a copy of this podcast to my lender and just let them know that you've pointed out that they need to lower the interest rate to make it the same as the owner-occupier rate.
Please do. You know, and to qualify, I was a mortgage broker for 12 years from early 2000s through to mid 2010s. Even during the GFC, and for those younger people, that was the global financial crisis in the late 2000s. There wasn't a need for interest rates to be higher for property investors, and it's the same security risk. They all have residential property as security. That's usually the number one determinant of interest rate risk, is the type of security. So when you look at that, there's no real issue for them to have a higher rate just because it's an investor. And what happens if you how would they know anyway? Like, you might say you're buying it as an investment now, but what if you move into it? Do you then get a lower rate automatically? And then what if you do get that lower rate and then 2 years later you move out of it and put another tenant in? Are you in breach if you don't tell them? It's just a cash grab from the banks.
Well, our final story today is something that is very, very topical. Population growth keeps increasing. Australia's population grew by an enormous 2.52% in the year to September 2023, according to the latest data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. To put that 2.52% growth figure in context, in data going back to 1981, population growth has averaged just 1.38% per year. In March 2020, when the pandemic began, population growth was 1.44%. By March 2021, due to the closure of the international border, population growth had plummeted to just 0.1%. And since then, population growth has increased every single quarter. And as I say, it's now up to 2.52%. The reason our population is growing so quickly is not because we're having lots of babies. Natural increase accounted for just 17% of that population growth. Rather, the reason for our strong population growth is our large migrant intake, which accounted for 83% of the population growth. Owen, I This is just my personal preference. I happen to be a fan of a big Australia and strong population growth, but I know a lot of people want slower population growth in order to ease pressure on housing and infrastructure and the environment. I'm keen to know your thoughts. Do you think our current level of population growth is too high or too low or about right?
I mean, there's really two answers there. It's yes, I 100% agree with you with needing more population growth, and in the long term and in the bigger picture from a macro point of view. But right here, right now, we are struggling to be able to house them. When we've got people in, when we've got Australians in Queensland who are, taking up residency in parks with tents because they can't get anywhere to live because there's not enough houses, then we have a real crisis. And it's not just in Queensland. These issues are all over the place. So it needs to be a measured growth. And there's only one reason why the government is letting this happen. It's because it's bolstering our economy. We need population to provide labor for the workforce. And it was being talked about over the weekend. I noticed that we need 80,000 more tradies in the country to be able to help with building all of these properties that we need. So there is a need, but it's, are we getting those 80,000 tradies as part of this population growth? There should be a priority made on them before anyone else, because otherwise it's just adding to the existing problem that we've got, and it's going to be decades before we catch up. In the meantime, we're creating a generation of homelessness and desperation for people to be able to get into a property. And it's there's no reason why we can't hold off somewhat now. Instead of doing the 2.5%. 2.52, let's pull it back to under 2, or 1.5. Yeah, let's stay on the average at least, and focus on the people that we really need to be able to help get this housing crisis under control as soon as possible.
What's interesting is, of course, there's debate over whether population growth is good and how much growth there should be if there is going to be population growth. But there seems to be a general acceptance that the population is going to grow. And I'm wondering, Owen, assuming that Australia's population does indeed keep increasing, how do you imagine our cities are going to change between now and, say, 2050?
That's interesting. And I think we do need more population in general, as we were just talking about. And it's something that as we go to more high-speed internet and we go to a more flexible workforce where it seems like hybrid and remote working is becoming more acceptable and the norm, we're going to have to put more infrastructure into more regional areas. But then our cities might become more dense, and there might become more concentrated mini cities within a larger metropolitan area. It's going to be interesting the way it develops. But then the smaller cities around the country might see an influx of higher population as well. It was interesting out of those population figures that came through that even though Sydney received the bulk of the international migration, there was also a huge interstate migration away from Sydney. So Sydney was still growing and growing rapidly, but there was still a lot of people leaving Sydney, heading to other states. So it's it'll be interesting. There's definitely a different dynamic after the last few years, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, some of those predictions you made sound interesting, and they sound insightful also. So I can imagine our capital cities expanding to the extent that they can, but I can also imagine at the same time that they're expanding that they're also going to become denser. And I can also imagine, as you said, that as they become denser and as we get more infrastructure, that instead of having, say, one CBD, there's probably going to be some cities within cities, as I think you kind of suggested. But then also the other point you mentioned, Owen, which I really hope does come true, to see more regional growth, I think partly to take some of the pressure off the big capital cities, but also some of these regional cities are just fantastic places to live. And I think the only thing holding them back right now is people want to live where the jobs are. And in some of these regional communities, there can be a shortage of jobs or maybe a shortage of high paying jobs. If we can get more jobs and higher paying jobs to these regional cities, they become even more attractive. And I would love to see some of these cities become even bigger and more successful than they are now.
Yes. And these regional areas, a lot of people move to them wanting to have that lifestyle and they don't want things to change. Even in pockets of the large cities like Sydney and Melbourne, there are people who, live in a beautiful part of Sydney and they don't want more people moving there. They don't want change. They don't want development, but they need to realise that they still live within a much larger community, even though they might feel like they're a small community that exists by itself. They still live within a major city and within a country called Australia, and they need to accept that they're going to change as everyone else is going to as well, and they need to take on their fair share. And then in the regional areas, I think this is there might not be a lot of jobs there for people to move there. But with the hybrid and the remote working availability now for a lot of people, there's a lot of people who have city jobs with city incomes who can work from regional areas and live in regional areas now, and which can bring money with it, and that will feed those local economies. And that will feed job creation in those local areas and those regional areas and those country towns. And I think that's an absolutely amazing thing that can happen for these regional areas. So, they should be doing everything to try and bring these people in.
Well, for our first podcast of 2050, and I'm sure we'll still be broadcasting then, let's revisit this episode and see how accurate our predictions were.
Yes, in 26 years' time.
Looking forward to it, Owen.
All right. Thank you, Nick. And we'll see you next week.
And in 2050.
Yes. See ya.